Hello, this is Randy Thompson sitting in for George Douglas. Welcome to the Triangle Radio Reading Services, The Week magazine, which offers the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's reading is from the issue dated June 22, 2012. The Triangle Radio Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. For the next hour, I shall be reading articles from these nine sections of The Week magazine, starting with the section called The Main Stories and running through these sections: Controversy of the Week, Good Week 4, Bad Week 4, People, Briefing, Best Columns in the U.S., The Last Word, and ending with the Talking Points section. But first, the main stories. The first story in this section is titled The Eurozone on the Brink. What happened? A Eurozone bailout of Spain's debt-ridden banks failed this week to calm growing panic that the euro could be about to unravel, as investors pushed Spain's borrowing costs to ruinous levels and Greece faced an election that could force its exit from Europe's common currency. The $125 billion aid package was intended to strengthen Spain's teetering banking sector, which is loaded with toxic excess following the collapse of a housing bubble, and prevent the region's fourth-largest economy from falling deeper into recession. Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy hailed the bailout as a victory for both Spain and Europe, but markets remain pessimistic. The rate on Spanish 10-year bonds, a measure of how much investors trust a country to repay its debts, shot up to 6.7%, a level that compelled Greece, Portugal, and Ireland to seek bailouts and could lead to Spain's bankruptcies. Yet more turmoil could be triggered by Greece's election on Sunday. The far-left Syriza Party, which is polling even with the conservative New Democracy Party, has vowed to abandon austerity measures demanded by the European Union if it gains a majority in Parliament. That could lead Eurozone leaders to pull the plug on further aid, forcing Greece out of the euro. Syriza leader Alexis Tsipras warned European leaders that kicking Greece out of the currency would trigger a catastrophic loss of confidence in other European countries' solvency and set off a Eurozone meltdown. The fire will become unquenchable and will not be limited to Greece, he said. What the editorial said: only one thing will save the European economy now, said the Washington Post. The continent's healthier nations, particularly Germany, must put together an equivalent of the massive, confidence-inspiring, troubled asset relief program that saved U.S. banks from imploding in 2008. But the Germans are still hesitant to co-sign eurobonds for their debtor neighbors, and all other remedies are but temporary band-aids. This week, interest rates on Italy's bonds also soared to 6.2%, and the investors' lack of faith is spreading. There isn't much time left. This is the price Europe has to pay for the original sin of bailing out Greece, said the Wall Street Journal. Bureaucrats in Brussels and Berlin originally claimed that overspending Athens couldn't be allowed to fail because default would lead to contagion to other countries, a European recession, and perhaps to the breakup of the Eurozone. But 2 years and three bailouts later, where are we? Europe is in recession, and contagion has spread to Spain, and perhaps next to Italy. What the columnists said. The immediate threat is a Greek exit from the Eurozone, said Abdur Chowdhury in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. If an anti-austerity government takes power and the country quits the euro and returns to a devalued drachma, Terrified depositors in Spain, Ireland, and Italy will make a run on the banks. Then the euro's collapse will all be but inevitable. President Obama's fate is tied to Europe, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. He'll be reelected only if voters perceive the economy to be improving. But a severe downturn across the Atlantic would cause American exports to Europe to plummet and global markets to crash, dropping the U.S. back into recession. Germany faces an agonizing dilemma, said Niall Ferguson in Newsweek. It must either agree to fund a strong Central European bank and thus absorb its southern neighbors' debts, or see the eurozone collapse. The collapse would destroy the market for nearly half of Germany's exports and cost the country hundreds of billions of euros. After 2 years of procrastination, Europe has reached the moment of truth. All the signs are bad, said Joe Nocera in the New York Times. Economists insist that Europe needs tighter political and fiscal integration to save the euro, but the eurozone consists of 17 nations, and sovereign governments, it turns out, do not willingly cede their sovereignty. Most Europeans would rather risk financial disaster than surrender their national identities and truly marry their economies, debt, and governments. Unless Europeans have a quick change of heart, the euro is doomed. The next main story is titled Sandusky Faces Accusers. Several alleged victims of Jerry Sandusky offered graphic and disturbing testimony of sexual abuse this week as the trial against the former Penn State assistant football coach opened in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania. One accuser, now 18, wept on the witness stand as he recounted repeated instances of sexual assault beginning when he was 11, and others testified that Sandusky repeatedly engaged them in oral sex and inappropriate touching after meeting them through his Second Mile charity. Former Penn State assistant coach Mike McQuarrie testified that he heard a skin-on-skin smacking sound and saw a naked Sandusky pressed up against a young boy in the locker room showers back in 2001. Sandusky, 68, has pleaded not guilty to 52 criminal counts of molesting 10 boys over 15 years. Defense lawyer Joe Amendola told the jury that Sandusky loves kids so much he does things that none of us would ever think of doing, but that his expressions of affection were not sexual. That's just part of what will be a distinctive sordid defense, said Amy Davidson in NewYorker.com. Sandusky's attorneys intend to argue that all of the alleged victims are lying for money and that taking showers with other people's children was part of Sandusky's culture. That strategy seems certain to backfire, said Phil Sheridan in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Victimizing the victims all over again is a despicable tactic, but then why expect honor from this man now? Sitting near a monster like Sandusky in the courtroom this week made me want to take a shower, said Maureen Dowd in the New York Times. What makes him especially vile is the way he targeted vulnerable boys using his charity as a perverted recruiting tool, putting asterisks next to the names of the boys who were fatherless and blonde. Victims recalled that Sandusky would stalk them incessantly and that their attempts to tell authority figures fell on deaf ears. Sandusky, they were told, had a heart of gold. Some still believe that, said Joel Achenbach in WashingtonPost.com. After one day of particularly devastating testimony, Sandusky stood chatting and laughing with a small group of old friends in the courtroom, delighted to have people who still believe in him. One friend of 40 years said, "I totally trust him. Like so many who never asked questions, they still can't imagine the worst." And now we turn our attention to controversy of the week. Obama, will his private sector gaffe cost him the election? Do It was only six words, said Alex Koppelman in NewYorker.com. But President Obama is paying a steep price for his gaffe last week that the private sector is doing fine. Within hours, the campaign of presidential rival Mitt Romney went into full attack mode, generating ads mocking Obama's indifference to Americans' economic misery, while Romney himself called it an extraordinary misunderstanding by a president that's out of touch. Obama just made presidential history, said John Pohoritz in the New York Post, joining a long list of candidates who've self-destructed with disastrous statements. In 2008, John McCain destroyed voters' confidence by saying, in the midst of the Wall Street meltdown, that the fundamentals of our economy are strong. 4 years earlier, John Kerry confirmed he was a flip-flopper when he said he'd voted to fund the Iraq troop surge before I voted against it. With 8.2% unemployment, stagnant wage growth, and widespread economic anxiety, Obama's breezy moment of complacency last week may prove to be the pivotal moment for the 2012 campaign. He might have used more sensitive phrasing, said Kevin Drum in MotherJones.com, but Obama was more right than wrong. The private sector of our economy is currently adding about 2 million jobs a year. Not great, but okay, given the historic depth of the recent recession. State and local governments, on the other hand, are shedding an average of 200,000 jobs a year. These workers are real people, and their unemployment creates significant drag on an already fragile economy. In mocking Obama, Romney committed an even bigger gaffe of his own, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. Incredulously, he said the president actually wants to see government hire more firemen, more policemen, more teachers as a boost to the economy. Imagine that. Romney's contempt for hard-working public servants, people who keep us safe and educate our children, will not be forgotten by the middle-class swing voters. Voters know that this election is about one thing, the economy, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. That's why Obama's self-inflicted wound is so devastating. By saying the private sector is fine, he only proved what voters already suspect. He's out of depth on the economy and hostile to private business. The last thing most Americans want to see is politicians like Obama spending more taxpayer money, hiring more government workers, creating more bureaucracy and more national debt. Indeed, Obama now looks utterly out of touch, as Romney will remind voters a few thousand times between here and November. When a guy building a California vacation mansion with a car elevator for his wife's two Cadillacs calls you out of touch and no one laughs, you know you're in trouble. I hate to spoil the fun, but gaffes don't matter, said Ezra Klein in WashingtonPost.com. In the heat of campaigns, every candidate makes them, creating an impressive blooper reel of brain freezes and verbal slip-ups. Remember Romney's, I like to fire people, and I'm not concerned about the very poor. Well, partisans gleefully seize on gaffes to justify their already dim view of opposition candidates. But one dumb statement changes few minds, and barely even registers with uncommitted voters who generally don't start following the campaigns closely until September. In an election when the two candidates are offering such dramatically different governing philosophies, you have to have an extraordinarily low opinion of voters to believe that verbal miscues are going to be the deciding factor. And now we have the second called Good Week 4, Bad Week 4. Well, it was evidently a good week for RoboCops. after Washington, D.C. collected a record $55.1 million in 2011 via 462,000 tickets issued by speed and red light cameras. Nearby, Montgomery County, Maryland, which is larger and more populous, took in only $19 million from the cameras during that time. Rising and shining, an ever good week, after a new University of Toronto study found that morning people are happier, healthier, and generally more satisfied with life than night owls. And finally, it's a good week for law-abiding citizens, after a new FBI crime report revealed that the violent crime rate in the U.S. dropped 4% in 2011 to near historic lows. Property crimes were also down slightly, the ninth consecutive annual decline. But it was a bad week for dropping an F-bomb in Middleborough, Massachusetts, which voted to allow police to issue $20 tickets for cursing in public. It was also a bad week for Junior Alexander Guy, a 49-year-old from Orlando who was assigned the cell phone number formerly used by George Zimmerman, the defendant in the Trayvon Martin murder case. Guy immediately began getting dozens of phone calls from strangers saying, "Murderer," and "You deserve to die." And it was a bad week for romantic gestures. After an Indiana man hired a hot air balloon to propose to his girlfriend, she accepted, but the balloon then collided with power lines, delivering a shock that knocked out the pilot, who toppled over the fiancée. The pilot and bride-to-be were hospitalized with non-life-threatening injuries. And that brings us to the people section. Lagerfeld's pet obsession. "Karl Lagerfeld is obsessed with his cat," said Mark Karamazdeya in Women's Wear Daily. Lagerfeld's current muse, male model Baptiste Gia Bicconi, recently asked the famously gruff fashion designer to look after his pet cat, Shoe Pet, while he was away traveling. "But then I refused to give her back," says Lagerfeld, 78. "I thought she was too cute." He now treats Choupette, a 9-month-old white Siamese, like a spoiled supermodel. "She's a kept woman," he explains. "She has lunch and dinner with me on the table with her own food. She doesn't want to eat on the floor. She sleeps under a pillow, and she even knows how to use an iPad. She has 2 personal maids for both night and day. When Lagerfeld is out of town, Choupette's assistants keep records of her day-to-day activities. When I am not there, the maids take down in little books everything she did, from what she ate to how she behaved, if she was tired and if she wasn't sleeping," he says. "We have almost 600 pages. It could be funny to make a little book of Choupette's diary." What Lagerfeld won't do, though, is design any outfits for his beloved kitty. "I don't like animals in human clothes. I think that's very circus-like." The Blade Runner's inspiration. Oscar Pistorius credits his mother with his success, said Alison Curvin in the Financial Times. The South African runner was born without a fibula, the smaller of the 2 bones between the knee and the ankle, in either leg. As a result, he became a double amputee before he was a year old and now competes in international races using blade-like prosthetic legs. His disability never held him back. He remembers a happy childhood full of games and sports. "I won a trophy for Greco-Roman wrestling when I was 6, says the sprinter. "I remember taking up boxing when I was about 9. It felt like nothing was off limits. At school, he competed against able-bodied pupils in triathlons and played tennis and water polo. It was his mother's love, coupled with her no-nonsense attitude, that gave him the confidence to live life to the fullest." He remembers, for instance, her saying to his brother, "Put your shoes on," then turning to him, "And you, put your legs on." She died when he was 15, leaving him devastated. He has the date tattooed on his arm and says she is still with him every day in everything he does. She taught him to believe in himself. That's what she gave me, he says. That's a lot to give a child. Self-belief. We now turn our attention to the briefing section. Me on Mars, Mandela. After decades of house arrest, dissident Aung San Suu Kyi now travels the world and sits in Parliament. Is her battle won? What role does Suu Kyi play in Myanmar? She has made herself a powerful symbol of the democratic aspirations of the Burmese people, challenging and eventually winning major concessions from the repressive military rulers who governed the backward nation for a half century. From birth, Aung San Suu Kyi seemed almost preordained to become the embodiment of her nation's hopes. Her father, Aung San, founded the Burmese National Movement when the country was a British colony and negotiated its independence after World War II. But he was assassinated in July 1947, 6 months before the country's launch as a republic, when Aung San Suu Kyi was only two. A 1962 coup d'etat installed a military government. Suu Kyi left Burma and studied in India. She later married British scholar Michael Eris and moved to the UK, where she brought up her children and studied at Oxford and the University of London. She moved back to Burma to nurse her dying mother in 1988, just a few months before the country's military ruler, General Ne Win, stepped down, triggering widespread pro-democracy demonstrations. How did she come to the fore? Called upon to speak as the daughter of Aung San, she roused a massive crowd with an explicit denunciation of the regime. At the very instant I saw her, I knew she is my leader, said Kim Wong-sui, a fellow democratic activist. After the military brutally put down the protest, Suu Kyi stayed on and embraced the role of political conscience for her 60 million compatriots, essentially from her first public speech, said Joseph Silverstein, a former Rutgers University professor and an expert on Myanmar. Suu Kyi became the only leader that the Burmese people have acknowledged since the death of her father back in 1947. How has the military handled her? Fearing her charisma and intelligence, the junta put Suu Kyi under house arrest in 1989 and kept her there for most of the next two decades, sometimes in solitary confinement. Yet it never managed to suppress her political influence. The junta rechristened Burma as Myanmar and held elections in 1990, but annulled the results after Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy secured 82% of the seats in Parliament. Fear of losing power corrupts those who wield it, she said that year, and fear of the scourge of power corrupts those who are subject to it. Suu Kyi won the Nobel Peace Prize the following year, but was unable to travel to Oslo to receive it, fearing that if she left the country, she would not be allowed to return. That's now changed. She recently made her first trip abroad in 24 years to neighboring Thailand, and this week she left for Europe, where she is to visit Switzerland, France, and Ireland, address both houses of the British Parliament, and finally deliver a Nobel acceptance speech in the Norwegian capital. Why was she released? Suu Kyi's freedom is the most visible result of the tentative steps towards democracy that the Burmese military has been forced to take in recent years. The tipping point came in 2008, 2007, when Buddhist monks turned against the austere and repressive regime, sparking what became known as the Saffron Revolution. The monks were outraged at the suffering of the people after the junta ended fuel subsidies, sending the price of gas and many other goods skyrocketing. The junta ultimately crushed that rebellion, but in a gesture towards democracy the following year, it wrote a new constitution that created a civilian government while reserving much power for the military. The regime released Suu Kyi from house arrest in November 2010. What is her official role now? She has become a vital actor in Myanmar's return to democracy. After her release, she began negotiating with the new, nominally civilian government of President Thein Sein. The government has freed some political prisoners, legalized unions, and agreed to sweeping economic reforms. Freedom of expression still falls far short of Western standards, but criticism of the status quo is now possible. Encouraged by the air of civic renewal, her NLD decided to run in by-elections this year, and Suu Kyi won a seat, officially becoming the leader of the parliamentary opposition. So, is Myanmar now a democracy? Not really. Asked recently how democratic Myanmar was on a scale of 1 to 10, Suu Kyi answered, on the way to 1. Her party controls just 43 of the more than 600 seats in parliament, and the constitution still allows the military to take over as needed. This week, the government declared martial law in the country's northwest after dozens of people were killed and scores of houses torched in clashes between Buddhist and a Muslim minority. Even before that outbreak of violence, Suu Kyi cautioned the international community and her own people against reckless optimism about Myanmar's future. "That's not going to help you," she said. "It's not going to help us." This brings us to the next section, Best Columns in the U.S. This includes three articles, Why Reagan's Wall Speech Mattered, that's by Peter Robinson in the Wall Street Journal, What Dies Along with Newspapers, that's by Alex Parine in Salon.com, and finally, The Futility of Banning Books by Ron Charles in WashingtonPost.com. But first, why Reagan's wall speech mattered. "25 years ago this week," said Peter Robinson, "Ronald Reagan stood in front of the Berlin Wall and uttered a sentence that changed the world. 'Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.' Did Reagan's speech that day really lead to Gorbachev's decision 2 years later to let Germany reunify? Gorbachev himself recently said it did not, dismissing the speech as a piece of theater by a president whose original profession was actor. But talk to former East Germans and Soviet dissidents, and you get a different perspective. Until Reagan gave voice to the startling idea that the wall should come down, they told me, the West accepted the Soviet Union's soul-crushing domination of Eastern Europe. Reagan, one East German said, changed our consciousness, giving people real belief that things could be different. When the world's most powerful man directly challenged the legitimacy of the Soviet Empire, it put everything in play, including the shocking idea that citizens of the Soviet bloc could live in freedom. Their struggle made it happen, but it was the American president who made them believe it was possible." And then we go to the article, What Dies Along with Newspapers. The decline of newspapers has wreaked havoc on the politics of middle America, said Alex Parine. Newspaper circulation and revenue are in free fall, and even those newspapers that haven't closed are decimating their staffs and reducing their coverage. In the dawning post-newspaper era, we will all continue to get plenty of detailed coverage of national politics, including a daily avalanche of heated partisan commentary but very little reporting on state and local governments. With the watchdogs gone, it's quite easy for politicians and parties to get away with a lot. Lobbyists are drafting outrageous industry-friendly or highly partisan legislation that state legislatures are ramming through verbatim. And why not? Most Americans now have a better sense of what's going on in Syria than in their state capital. We've also lost the referee role played by daily newspapers in their communities. Editors used to either ignore kooks and extremists or treat them as such. However, much this annoyed the rabid precincts of both the left and the right. It helped to forge a grand national moderate compromise that made our system work. Don't kid yourself. Our democracy will miss newspapers badly. The futility of banning books, the next article. Nothing boosts book sales like condemnation by a church, said Ron Charles. Just ask Sister Margaret Farley, a Catholic theologian, whose book, Just Love, was languishing at number 142,982 on Amazon sales. Lists when the Vatican censored it last week, saying it could cause grave harm to the faithful. Within days of that announcement, Farley's book, which make the moral case for sexual pleasure within any kind of loving relationship, hit number 16 on the bestseller list. Once again, we see what happens to sales when a religious authority tells the faithful to look away. But that's a temptation religious authorities have not been able to resist ever since Gutenberg invented the printing press. Evangelical churches have tried and failed to ban books by Tolkien and Steinbeck. More recently, they condemned Harry Potter and the Nikos Kazantzakis' The Last Temptation of Christ. In every case, interest in these works grew. Similarly, Ayatollah Khomeini imposed a fatwa on Salman Rushdie after he published the Satanic Verses in 1988, turning Rushdie into a literary superstar. Ayatollahs, ministers, and popes, it seems, will never accept a basic truth. Trying to regulate what people read is counterproductive. And that brings us to the last word. What my father gave me. Sometimes I think my dad is nuts, says Joel Stein, but his belligerence had a purpose. My father has scars on his knuckles, one of which is permanently bent. This is not something you would think is easy to work into conversation. Yet I've been told many, many times how he got them. As a teenager in the Bronx, he took on the duty of protecting smaller Jews from large anti-Semitic Italians. I figured, despite the physical evidence, that the number and severity of these fights, some of which involved knives, were exaggerated. It's not that my dad lies, it's that he never tells stories in which he doesn't come out looking really good. I am deeply suspicious of this, since I do not have any stories in which I come out looking even moderately good. But he wasn't exaggerating. When my dad and I went to visit my 89-year-old grandmother, Mama Ann, in her condo in Fort Lauderdale, I asked her what my dad was like as a kid. As soon as he learned to walk, he only walked one way, she said. When I asked Mama Ann what that meant, she explained that my dad was not conflict avoidant. Your father would walk up to kids and hit them. He'd get in trouble. Then he'd learned, he said, he hit me first. My father's aggression was so severe, and this is back in the 1940s, his pediatrician recommended putting him on drugs to calm him down, which my grandmother had to talk my calm, patient grandfather out of doing. While Mama Ann told this story, my 70-year-old father kept interrupting her with, "You mess with me, I'm going to mess with you." I now believe there are a lot of knuckle-scarred 70-year-old Italians from the Bronx talking about the violent, racist Jew. The day after seeing Mama Ann, I took my dad and sister to the South Beach Wine and Food Festival in Miami. We were waiting in a long, slow line for crepes when a guy and two women cut to the front. My dad told the guy in his early 30s to get the back of the line. Line vigilantism is something I deal with a lot, and not just with my dad. My wife, Cassandra, is often telling people to get to the back of the line, people who, she then discovers, have been in line a lot longer than us, and she just didn't notice them. I do not understand the obsession with line justice. People are born in war-torn countries where they starve to death while others get the free passes to the food and the wine festivals. And line order is where people demand fairness? I'm more than willing to put in 30 extra line seconds in exchange for not having to serve as a line border patrol agent. But once people form a single file, they are suddenly full committed to the idea of equal treatment for all sisters and brothers. I honestly believe that the civil rights movement would have happened years earlier if instead of sending black people to the back of the bus, they made them wait at the end of the line. When my dad told the guy at the food and wine festival to go to the back of the line, the guy and his two female friends boldly refused, standing there with their plates out, crepe expectant. My sister and I had already decided that 30 minutes for a crepe wasn't worth it, but my dad wouldn't leave. When we returned with lobster rolls and conch chowder, my dad, to our surprise, was not only still in the endless line, but also still in a feud with the line cutter. In fact, he was in the line cutter's face, calling him Buddy. When Buddy ignored him, my dad asked Buddy to take this outside and fight. Let me remind you that my dad was 70 and at a food and wine festival and waiting for a crepe. Not a savory crepe, but a chocolate crepe with whipped cream. Buddy, in response to the challenge to fight a 70-year-old man with glasses dangling from a rope around his neck, said he was a lawyer and would sue if my dad hit him. My dad got a few inches from Buddy's face and told him that he was a partner at one of the biggest law firms in Manhattan, which is not at all true. My dad then repeated his offer to take this outside. Buddy did not move. But my dad blocked him from any hopes of getting a crepe, thus becoming the hero of the crepe line. My father handed crepes to several people behind us before taking our crepes and departing to everyone's approval. It was one of the finest moments of civil rights the crepe line at the South Beach Wine and Food Festival would ever witness. My dad will work pretty hard to get his justice. He has spent the last 10 years exacting revenge on his local Waldbaum supermarket because they scanned a half gallon of Breyer's ice cream at $3 instead of the posted sale price of $2. He takes dairy items that have passed their expiration dates and returns them so they're put back on the supermarket shelves. These rancid products, he hopes, will be purchased by customers who will complain. This is his method of recruiting for his army. Sure, it's a sickly army doubled over with food poisoning, but it's an army nevertheless. My father, I've started to realize, might actually be a psycho. He volunteered in the National Guard when he was 24 during the Vietnam War, right after getting a letter telling him to report to his Army recruiter because he was being drafted. After basic training, when he was training to be a tanker, he got in a fight with his sergeant. He was writing a letter home to his parents, and his sergeant grabbed it and started reading it out loud, making fun of it. So my dad grabbed it back. The sergeant pushed my dad, and my dad punched the sergeant in the face. This part of the story always seemed a bit extreme to me, since it involved punching someone in the face. No one I talked to had ever heard of a private punching a sergeant. Punching a sergeant in the face is as insane as being a Soviet citizen in a May Day parade and punching Joseph Stalin in the face. I felt I was superior to all of these sergeants who were yelling at people, my dad told me. They were misfits. Basically, I would laugh. It was funny to me. These were a bunch of low-life hillbillies yelling at me to eat fast. Yeah, I'm going to eat fast. You know when there's a real threat and when there's a bunch of guys trying to act tough? You didn't have a bunch of Harvard graduates yelling at you. This is where my father and I see life differently. If a bunch of Harvard grads were yelling at me to eat faster, I wouldn't be scared. Harvard grads, for the most part, are not known as a face-hitting bunch. They're more likely to mock me years later in a brief reference on The Simpsons. Morons, however, are face-hitters. My dad was given Article 15 from the Uniform Code of Military Justice, in which he had to sign a piece of paper and let his commander decide his fate, which is typically 14 days of punishment and restrictions and the loss of 1 week of pay. But my dad refused to sign the paper, which meant he'd get a court-martial trial. I said, fine, court-martial me. I knew I could make a monkey of these guys on the stand. They didn't want to deal with the hassle of a court-martial, so instead the drill sergeant just made my dad spend his nights moving sand from one pile to another with a spoon for a week, which my dad pretended to like. When the guys would sit down to rest, I would stand because I wanted to give it to the sergeants. They would hand me water. I would say I didn't need water. They would call me New Yorker, which was code for Jew. They had images in their minds I wanted to change. There was an image of myself in my dad's mind that I've always wanted to change, too. All my father ever wants for his birthday is a letter. For this last one, his 70th birthday, I wrote, "It must have been frustrating that I didn't know how to fight, or stick up for myself, or be aggressive. I wanted him to know that I realize my main deficiencies and have worked hard to fix them so I won't pass them down to my 3-year-old son, Laszlo." Nearly every time I've talked to my dad since, he's brought that sentence up, flummoxed that he could be so misunderstood. He didn't care if I was like him. He was proud of me for all of the ways I'm not like him. He calls me the more polished version of him, though it's not all that hard to seem polished when the original version challenges people to fisticuffs at food and wine shows. When I asked my dad why he never taught me any man stuff, he mentioned my mom, the 1970s, feminism, and my mom again. I should have been more assertive on this and many more things. It was not her fault, but my lack of courage, he said. But while he wishes he'd introduced me to a few more manly activities, he doesn't regret not pushing them on me. Trying to get your son interested in what you're interested in might be good for your ego, but it's not good for the child. You see what he likes, what he doesn't like. You can certainly tell with Laszlo by now. You pay more attention to him than anything in your life. You see what lights up his face and what he wants to do. When my mom decided to leave my dad, she went to a therapist and told a story about being impressed with my father when they first met. "I was 17 years old, and I was a little spacey, as I still am," she said. "I'll never forget being at his house and seeing that he had a file cabinet. I said, 'What do you put in there?' He asked, 'Where do you put your papers?' I said, 'My purses.'" My mom told her therapist that what she loved about my dad was that he made her feel safe in the world, and the therapist made her realize that he didn't. She took care of lots of things herself. She made herself feel safe. The therapist was wrong, though. My dad does make people feel safe. It's the very best thing about him. My dad still pays for every meal we have together. Sure, he could make me feel successful by letting me pay, which would be generous, too, but instead, he's created this unshakable relationship where he is the provider. It makes me know that if I ever need help, he will be the first one there. My dad gave me the very manliest gift, feeling safe, because once you feel safe, you can take risks. I want to make Laszlo feel that way, and now I think I might be capable of doing that, just like my dad did. And now we turn our attention to talking points. We'll also be getting into some wit and wisdom here, and we'll end up with Poll Watch. But first, talking points. The first talking point piece is entitled, Bill Clinton, a Dangerous Surrogate. With friends like Bill Clinton, Barack Obama better watch his back, said Sam Youngman in Reuters.com. While fundraising and campaigning as Obama's number one surrogate, the popular former president last week went off message on several critical issues, leaving Democrats fuming. First, Clinton used a national TV interview to praise Mitt Romney's business career as sterling and defended the work of venture capital firms, directly contradicting a key Obama line of attack. Clinton also suggested that the country was still in a recession and spoke of extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. You could practically hear Obama's campaign team howling in anguish. Everyone has a theory why the big dog causes these commotions, said John Dickinson in Slate.com. Some say he is deliberately sandbagging Obama, his rival for Democrats' affections. Others suspect he's hoping to boost Romney into an economically disastrous presidency so that Hillary can claim the White House in 2016. Asking why of Bill Clinton is a sucker's game, said Jonah Goldberg in BostonHerald.com. He's apologized for his gaffes, insisting he's aghast at any suggestion that he wants Obama to lose. But as we've learned, a Clinton reply is the verbal equivalent of an ice sculpture, impressive, but not expected to last long in the light of day. The only reliable truth about the man is that he has lots of complex motives, all of them self-serving. If you doubt that, consider what surrogate Clinton said in an Obama fundraiser last week, said Kyle Smith in the New York Post. Remember me, Clinton said. I'm the only guy that gave you four surplus budgets out of the eight I spent. Ouch! In other words, four more than Obama will ever deliver. Clinton's problem is that he fancies himself the country's foremost political consultant, said Bob Shrum in the DailyBeast.com. But over the years, his counsel has been hardly infallible. In 2000, he kept trying to steal attention from presidential candidate Al Gore. But Clinton's personal negatives is that post-Lewinsky era helped cost Gore the election. In 2004, Clinton divided John Kerry's campaign with his unsolicited meddling, and in 2008 he damaged Hillary's presidential bid with his unsettling, racially tinged attacks on Obama in South Carolina. So, Mr. President, continue to give advice, but not in the media. Then there will be no reason to think with friends like Bill Clinton. The next Talking Points article is titled Prenatal Testing. Too much information? We're about to enter a brave new world of prenatal testing, said Rosie Mestel in the Los Angeles Times. Using only a blood sample from the mother and a swab of the father's saliva, researchers at the University of Washington have, for the first time, mapped an 18-week-old fetus's entire genetic blueprint. The procedure, which uses parents' genetic information to identify bits of fetal DNA in the mother's blood, is not yet commercially available, but once perfected, it could be used to develop a single test to screen unborn babies for 3,000 genetic disorders such as cystic fibrosis and Tay-Sachs. This breakthrough could not come at a better time, said Roger Highfield in the Daily Telegraph, UK. As the average maternal age has increased over the past few decades, so has the risk of birth defects. Currently, doctors can test for genetic defects only by using invasive methods like amniocentesis, which raise the risk of miscarriage. But genetic testing this detailed creates a grave risk of its own, said Wesley Smith in NationalReview.com. Will science now accelerate the ongoing search and destroy mission against all defective children? Based on current trends, this is a real danger, we increasingly feel entitled not only to have a baby, but to have a baby of the kind and nature we want. Already 90% of unborn babies shown to have such genetic conditions as Down syndrome and dwarfism are aborted. Some perfection-thinking parents may use the new test for even more superficial reasons, said Christine Hawkins in FoxNews.com. They may decide to abort if tests show that the potential offspring lacks its father's athletic prowess or its mother's blonde hair and blue eyes. The justifications for these genetically discriminatory abortions will be limitless. Nonetheless, said William Salatin in Slate.com, the availability of these tests is inevitable. Polls show that most Americans support legal abortion as an option when prenatal tests show a serious physical or mental impairment. Look what happened to GOP presidential candidate Rick Santorum when he criticized prenatal testing as a gateway to abortion. By a 60-30 margin, respondents to a National Journal poll disagreed and said insurers should be required to pay for genetic testing. Pro-lifers like Santorum can bemoan such testing, but insisting that parents be denied information about their fetuses is a politically untenable position. Like it or not, much more sophisticated prenatal testing is coming and will almost certainly increase the abortion rate. The next Talking Points article is entitled Wisconsin, the Lessons of Walker's Victory. We have just witnessed the Icarus moment for public sector unions in America, said Charles Krauthammer in the Washington Post. Wax wings melted. There is nowhere to go but down. The labor movement thought it could make an example of Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker after he pushed through a law last year stripping teachers, and other unionized public employees of their right to bargain with bought-off legislators for lavish pensions, health care benefits, and salaries. Enraged, the unions launched a recall effort to punish Walker, but last week Walker won the recall election by a whopping 7 percentage points. Clearly, Americans are fed up with the sweetheart contracts enjoyed by public unions, which have left state and local governments as economically unsustainable as the collapsing entitlement states of Southern Europe. The Tea Party movement was created to fight against a similar American collapse, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, and in Wisconsin the movement proved it is still going strong, mobilizing more voters than the unions did. Walker won for a simple reason, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times. He had the financial support of the Bougainvilleas Boys Clubs. Thanks to the Supreme Court's notorious 2010 Citizens United ruling, union-hating conservatives like the Koch brothers were able to pump unlimited cash into Walker's campaign. As a result, Walker outspent his Democratic opponent, Tom Barrett, by 8-1. Still, progressives better not dismiss this election as an anomaly, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. In the post-Citizens United world, Democrats will be vastly outspent in any race the super wealthy deem important to their agenda. That is our new political reality, unless progressives make a priority of passing new campaign finance laws. Enough with the excuses, said Clive Cook Crook in the Atlantic.com. Yes, Walker may have outspent Barrett in Wisconsin, but he didn't win through the endless repetition of stupid, annoying TV spots. He won because the voters of a progressive-leaning state have realized they can't afford to give public employees pensions and benefits that are better than anything available in the private sector. Conservatives also ought not delude themselves, said Ramesh Ponnururu in Bloomberg.com. Walker just spent a year enmeshed in a bruising and bitter recall campaign in which his opponents routinely likened him to Hitler. Anyone expecting other governors to follow Walker's lead and take on their own public unions may be overestimating that breed's tolerance for criticism and controversy. How How about some wit and wisdom? And also our poll watch. Under wit and wisdom, we see this quote by Robert Louis Stevenson. There is only one difference between a long life and a good dinner. That is, the dinner, the sweets, come last. And then Helen Keller. Self-pity is our worst enemy, and if we yield to it, we can never do anything wise in this world. And then Albert Einstein. Creativity is intelligence having fun. And finally, Mae West. You only live once, but if you do it right, once is enough. Under Poll Watch, the percentage of Republicans who say the government should take care of people who can't take care of themselves has dropped from 62% in 1987 to 40% today. This is from the Pew Research Center. And secondly, under Poll Watch, 84% of Mormon registered voters say they will vote for fellow Mormon Mitt Romney, while 13% say they will support President Obama. About 2% of Americans are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, according to a Gallup poll. And under the column titled Notes, we see the following. More active duty U.S. troops have committed suicide this year than have been killed in battle. There have been 154 suicides among troops through last week, an average of one a day, compared with 124 U.S. military fatalities in Afghanistan, according to the Associated Press. Also, about 58% of high school seniors admit to texting while driving. According to a new study of 15,000 teenagers, texting and cell phone use behind the wheel is a national epidemic, said Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, Associated Press. And finally, a 66-foot-long dock from Misawa, Japan, sucked out to sea by the March 2011 tsunami, washed ashore near Newport, Oregon last week. Japanese scientists estimate that 1.5 million tons of debris from the tsunami is floating in the Pacific, and it has begun showing up on U.S. shores, according to the Los Angeles Times. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, filling in for George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long, until next time.